found out this morning, it's a different kind of feeling when you are not pastor of the church you're preaching at, but you're a member of that church. It's not anything except different, but you get different responses from folks. Several of us were standing in the hallway behind the sanctuary prior to worship. Stacy Cummer, one of our college students from Chapel Hill, came up and we greeted, and she said, you're preaching today, and I guess you got your sermon ready. And I said, well, I'm going to Charles' study and see if I can't find one in a few minutes. I'm trying to find somebody who's got a key. And Jim Blackman said, yeah, make sure you look under M for Mother's Day. And Rose DeRose said, then look under S for short. Never had anybody say that to me for 17 years when I was a pastor. Maybe Rusty remembers when I preached here before, they always put my watch on the pulpit. Preachers like to do that. It doesn't mean anything. We never look at them. You know, it just fools you into thinking that we're time conscious. I'm going to go back and pick up on one verse from our passage of Scripture that Jody and Dave read, one that you're very familiar with, 1 Corinthians 13:13. So faith, hope, love, abide. These three. But the greatest of these is love. This is the word of God for us, the people of God. We give thanks unto God. Would you pray with me, please? God of our life, who cares infinitely about every aspect of who we are, who desires so very much to say a word to us as we gather each Sabbath day, a word that would continue to nurture what is there, a word that would take seed, that as we move forth from this place, we would be different in the days ahead, and that the people that we encounter, somehow, some way, big or small, would sense that their life is different because the two of us have touched. You are this kind of God. We are your people. We give you our hearts to speak to now. In the name of the Galilean. Amen. I recall several years ago when I saw the movie Ordinary People. It was quite powerful. I was totally absorbed in it. From beginning to end, I was thoroughly enthralled. Afterwards, however, I was perplexed as to how the title of the movie, Ordinary People, connected with the movie itself. I pondered that for a while, and then it became crystal clear. The movie centered around one family's response to a tragic event in their life. Their two sons, who were very close, had gone rafting on a large river. A storm blew up. It began to rain and clouds swirled in. The torrent of the river became tremendous. Their raft capsized, and they both were clinging to the raft, trying to save on to get to the bank and somehow rescue themselves. But one named Buck, a blonde young man who was strong, very athletic, very gregarious, very handsome, in the midst of all that was going on, lost his grip and he slipped away into the river and drowned. The correlation between the movie and its title? Just this. Ordinary people experience tragedy. Ordinary people need to be loved. ordinary people respond to grief in different ways. The mother's response was that of stoicism. She basically stone-faced life after that. Her goal was to show no emotion, but the one emotion that perpetually came out from her was that of hostility. And it was focused on the son who survived. You see, Buck, the one who died, was her favorite. And she blamed the one who remained for Buck's death, saying in no uncertain terms, he could have done something to save Buck, and communicating to him in her way that if she had had a choice, the one who survived would have been the reverse. The boy himself was completely enamored with guilt. Grieving in the loss of his brother who was his close friend, and feeling the absolute total rejection of his mother, the father stood in between the two of them, somehow expending all of his energy attempting to hold the family together, to keep it from fragmenting and shattering, having no energy or time to deal with his own grief. All three of them crying out in their own way, "Someone, heal me. Someone, love me." Ordinary people need to be loved, because love is the world's greatest healing power. One of the most poignant moments in the movie came when the son, who simply could not deal with the enormity of his grief, attempted suicide, but he failed. He then began to see a counselor who cared a great deal for him and invested himself in the boy. He gave him permission to call him any time, day or night, if he felt the need to talk. In one particular session, this young man, whose self-esteem was so broken and so shattered, in essence, couldn't believe that this counselor was giving so much of himself to him. He said to him, "Why do you bother with me?" And he looked at him and he said, "Because I love you." Those words were so unfamiliar to him that they stunned him. He said, "You love me?" He said, "Yes." And then he reached out and embraced him, and they wept together. That was a turning point in that young man's life. From that moment on, suicide was not an option for him. Learning to live again was his goal. Love has that kind of transforming power on ordinary people. Those Corinthians that we read from Paul's letter to were a cluster of Christians, ordinary people, but they were riddled with problems in their church. There was a great deal of infighting and bickering among themselves, and they were taking their disputes into courts of law. Their personal lives were in shambles. Marriages were breaking up all around them. There was chaos in the worship service, particularly around the issue of speaking in tongues. When they gathered for the Lord's Supper, which in that day was a meal, and then the observance of the Lord's Supper, the wealthy arrived early. They ate the majority of the food. They drank an inordinate amount of wine, became drunk to a point. When the working class and poor people in the church arrived, all they had to eat were leftovers. And there were obviously two different distinctions in that church. People in the church worshiped idols. There was a leader in the church who was involved in a sexual relationship with his stepmother. We have a picture of a church in absolute bedlam. I mean, they gave new meaning to that phrase of, we got problems down in our church. The pastor, Paul, was away. He received reports of all of the division and the conflicts happening. He couldn't travel to them, so he wrote very extensively to them, giving them instructions and guidelines how to resolve their problems, how to address the issues before them. And then after several lengthy pages, 12 biblical chapters, Paul in essence said to them, but all the guidelines, all the instructions, all the understandings won't resolve the conflict completely. Eventually, those will fail. No, said Paul, those instructions and guidelines need to be coupled with one thing, something he called the more excellent way. He said they must be bathed with love. Only love, Paul was saying, can resolve this mess. And then he went on to say, love is the greatest. Preaching will pass on, said Paul. Knowledge has its limits. Faith is wonderful. Hope is marvelous. But they don't measure up to that which is the greatest. There's one thing that reigns supreme, high, high above all else, and that is love. Only love, said Paul, can truly transform. And it is indeed true. Love and only love brings about that which transforms. It's an old message. It's one that we've heard since we were the ages of the kids who were here earlier. Little tiny tops, we've heard that. And we know it's true, but if it is true, why is it that we don't let that transforming power of love touch our lives more than it does? What do we need to do to set it free more often? We first have to realize that this takes a very special kind of love. It's not a human love. Human love against the most difficult issues of life will fail. Human love against the great struggles that we endure is impotent. It takes a transforming love that comes only from God, the love that was in Jesus Christ, the love that is in us because Christ lives in us. It is Christ's love that transforms. It was Christ's love that changed that lead disciple, Peter. Big mouth, eccentric, prone to emotional outbursts, Jesus' love transformed him into a solid leader, one who was able to keep himself under control, to be rational, so much so that he was known as a rock. It was the love of Jesus Christ that transformed Zacchaeus from a man of greed to a man of generosity. It was the love of Christ that changed John, a man of inordinate ambition and selfishness, to a man of servanthood, who eventually wrote more about love than anyone in the New Testament. It is true. It is this special kind of love of Jesus Christ that truly transforms. Ben Hayden, the pastor of the First Presbyterian Church of Chattanooga, Tennessee, tells of receiving a phone call from one day from an employer of one of his congregational members. This man said, Pastor Hayden, I'm confused about something and I've got to find the answer to it, and someone told me you might be able to help me understand. And then he told him, he said, there was a woman who's a member of your church now, as I understand it, who, frankly, we were going to terminate because of the way she treated people. He said, we've had her here as an employee for years, but she has continually become more abrasive, more self-focused, more intolerant of others, and making the workplace intolerant. And though she is quite productive, we simply can no longer, we thought, allow her to create the conflict and problems that she was causing. He said, and then she began to be gentle and kind and understanding. And he said, I don't know what happened. Can you tell me? And Hayden said, yes, I can. And he told him this woman had asked Christ into her life and how Christ had changed her. That's what the love of Christ can do. Paul Powers was one of 12 children. Both of his parents were alcoholics. His mother died when he was a young boy. His father, as he continued to drink, became a very angry, abusive man. Reports came from neighbors to social services that the abuse was happening, so one day a social worker paid an unannounced visit to the home, and she interviewed all the children and asked them about the abuse, and they were very afraid, and they denied that it was going on. After she left, the father marched them all down into the basement and beat them, each one of them, to continue to embed that fear in them. Eventually, all of the children were farmed out into foster homes. And so very typically, Paul began to act out, as many teenagers in that situation did, all of the chaos and pain of his life. He was sentenced to prison, but in prison, he became a Christian after watching Billy Graham films. When he was released, he met and married a Christian woman. They had a little girl. All this time, no word from his father. Then one day, the phone rang. It was Paul's dad. The train he was on had stopped in the city that they lived in, and it would just be there for a short time, and he was hoping that he could see Paul. Paul and his wife got in the car as they traveled across the city. Enormous anxiety was going on. What will this be like? How will things go? I haven't seen him in all these years. What kind of man is he now? But when they met his dad came up to him and embraced him. And then they began to talk, and he asked Paul about his life. The conversation had to be very brief because they only had about 3 minutes together. And then his dad said, son, I would like for us to get to know each other again. And they made plans for their next meeting. And then for the first time in his life, Paul heard these words from his dad. Son, I love you. Paul eagerly awaited that next meeting with great joy and anticipation, but it never came. In just a few days, a phone call came saying that his dad had died at the age of 79. And there was that remaining question, what had happened to Dad? Why had he changed so much? He got his answer when he attended the funeral as the minister stood and talked about this man who had been so mean, so cruel, who had given his life to Christ, and how Christ had transformed him. This transforming love
is not a human love. It is the love of Jesus Christ in us. Secondly, if it's going to take place, you and I must realize that this love is not easy. Love is demanding. It takes time. It takes energy. It takes investment. And it takes courage. It takes all those things to be a mother, to be a father, to be a parent. It takes courage. James Dobson, in his marvelous book, Instructions, calls it well as he titled that book, Parenting Isn't for Cowards. It's true. Parenting, in my opinion, is the hardest job in the whole world. Nothing measures up to its difficulty. We all know that. It has its challenges. A woman was pushing her 2-year-old in her grocery cart down an aisle. There was a woman standing observing and reading some prices on some other items, and she heard the woman go by, and she heard her saying, "Be calm, Margaret. Don't cry, Margaret. It'll be all right, Margaret." And the woman was impressed by that, so she walked over to her and she said, "Ma'am, I don't mean to impose, but I just want to commend you on trying to be such a good mother to your daughter, Margaret." She said, "Ma'am, you don't understand. I'm Margaret." It's difficult. Sometimes you work and you think you're making progress as a parent, and you feel like that courage you're taking is having effect, and then sometimes it goes askew, like the parents of a teenage boy who they've been trying to train him to be sensitive and to express affirmation of others and not think about himself so much. And one day he came in and his mother was at the sink, and he said to her, "Mom, those are beautiful blue shorts you have on. They're new, aren't they?" And she said, "Yes." And he said, "Well, they're such a beautiful blue." And she was just taken back by that. And she said, "Well, son, thank you so much." He said, "They really are. Did you know they match the veins in the back of your leg?" It takes courage to be a parent. It takes courage to face the pain that goes with what we must do. Pain of disciplining. I talked once with a teenage girl who had crossed over the white line. She was behaving in some areas that were not self-destructive by any means, but they could have easily led to other things that would have been. And her parents found out. She came and said she wanted to talk about that, and we talked about it, and I listened to her, and then I said, "How did your parents respond? What did they say?" And she said, "They told me not to do it again, and they told me they loved me." And then I asked her, "What was it you wish they had done or said?" And without hesitating, she said, "I wanted them to ground me." I said, "You wanted them to ground me?" She said, "Yes." "Why?" "Then I would have known they loved me." You see, kids need limits. They know they need limits. They may buck us when we force them into limits. But all along, deep inside, they know my parents really do care. I can't put limits on myself in some ways, in some areas. I need somebody else to do it. I sure am glad my mom and dad will do it for me. Now, they may fight us, but we as parents must have the courage to stand up against that pain that that creates in order to discipline. But on the other end of the scale is that we must have the courage to set them free as they seek to be and discover who they are and not try to control their lives. As painful as that is, we must let them make their own mistakes. 2 years ago, a teenage girl, was about junior, senior in high school, came and she said, "Bill, I've had a recurring dream, and I know that you believe that God speaks to us sometimes in our dreams, and I hope that I could tell you about it, and you might help me interpret it. I said, okay, let's talk about it. And she said, my dream is that of two bulldozers in a field. One bulldozer is small, the other is very large, and the big one keeps coming toward the smaller one. The smaller one can't get away from it. It's not as fast, and it keeps moving toward it, and soon it's going to run over it. And she said, just as it gets to it, I wake up. I said, who's the big bulldozer? She said, I don't know. Who is the small bulldozer? I don't know. We talked on, and then I said to her, tell me, who's trying to run your life now? And she snapped and began to cry. And then she went on to tell me how much her mother was controlling and dominating everything she did and smothering her personal identity and not giving her the freedom that any teenager desires and needs and must have, and how it was fragmenting their relationship and ruining it and does to this day. It takes courage to allow ourselves to feel that necessary discomfort and pain to give our children freedom that they need. Dr. Dobson is right. Parenting isn't for cowards, but I add to that, love in any relationship isn't for cowards. It takes courage. Courage to be vulnerable, to be non-defensive, to give up on the idea, I've got to win, to risking admitting that we were wrong, to asking for forgiveness, to honesty at all costs. One of the significant points in our marriage came after we had been married about 3 years, and my wife and I had some tension between us for 2 days and couldn't resolve it, couldn't get to it. And finally, on the second night, I said to her, what's bothering you? Tell me. And she sat down and she said, I have realized I can't meet all your expectations. I said, what do you mean? She said, you've been trying to change me, and I tried to be what you want me to be, and I just can't do it. And I asked to be specific, and she was, and I saw what she was saying. I asked her forgiveness, and I began to go to work on setting her free. Her risking that, having that courage, freed me up in a few months to have the courage to come back to her and say, you know, I've got to be honest, you've tried to change me too. You see, that's a basic issue in every marriage. When we get married, and we get into our marriage, we try to help God out. God made us in His image, but well, that's not good enough for us, the husband and wife. We try to reshape each other into being in the image that we want the other to be. Every husband and wife must deal with that issue. It's a crossroads. And once and only when you cross that journey and set each other free to change by choice, not by pressure, can you go to the level of love. That takes courage to love in that way, to do as Paul says in Ephesians 4:15, to speak the truth in love. If this love is going to transform us, thirdly, we must never give up. This was the case with the mother in the movie. She wouldn't let anybody love her. She built a wall of hostility around her. And any time someone tried to enter that wall in a significant way, she lashed out at them in anger and kept them away. There are many that we try to love who are craving intimacy and needing this love, but they have built walls around themselves, walls that have different names, walls of fear and hurt and anger and unforgiveness and bitterness, walls of loneliness. That's a kind of love that is difficult, but we must never give up. Jesus never gave up on Judas. He loved Judas as much as he loved Peter, James, and John and all the other disciples. But Judas built a wall around himself, a wall of greed and ambition. But Jesus never gave up on him. I believe at that Last Supper, when they were there in their intimacy, Jesus spoke those words to Judas with pain when he said, "Do what you must do, but do it quickly." It hurt him so much because he never quit loving Judas. Because, as Paul says, love never ends. There's a father who had a son who rebelled, and his rebellion continued to go on and on. Finally, he began to break the law, and after one such episode, his father had to post bond for him, and the next day he was telling his neighbor about it. And his neighbor, in his exasperation himself with all he had heard about his neighbor's son, and he said, "Why don't you give up on him? If he were my son, I'd give up on him." And the father said, "If he were your son, I'd give up on him too. But he's my son, and I will never give up on him." You and I must never give up on people. We can't force our love on them. You can't make someone love you, but we simply must hang around and gently tap on the door of our heart every now and then to let them know that we're there and to let them know that we're willing to love them if they will receive it. But we can't buy that mask, that charade, that wall, because really what they're doing behind that wall and their reluctance to let us in, they're asking, "Is your love authentic? Can I trust you, or will you hurt me like others have?" In 1988, as I pastored the church that I was at before I moved to Baptist Hospital, our youth group returned from its annual mission trip. They had been down the coast of North Carolina working in one church, having backyard Bible studies and holding a vacation Bible school in the afternoon. They went to the homes of the elderly in the community and cut grass, cut down weeds, limbs, and haul off trash, and then at night they went to a little area close to the pier, and they held a worship service. They got back on Saturday afternoon. I went down to the church to welcome them, and then when everyone had gone, I said to the youth director, whose name was Joe, "Joe, let's go down to the office and tell me about the week." We went in and sat down, and she had this little coy smile on her face, and I said, "What's that?" And she said, "Well, now I want you to hear me." She said, "I know you've tried to tell me not to try to rescue everybody, but listen to me all the way through." I said, "Okay." She said, "About Tuesday, our kids befriended a young man, a 19-year-old boy, down on the beach. He and a couple of the guys slept under the pier, and they surfed during the day and just kind of scavenged around for food, doing a little odd jobs every now and then just to get enough to get them by. And the kids struck up a friendship with him, and he started hanging out with us. And then he started coming to our cottage at night for devotions. And he just went everywhere with us. He went to the worship services down by the pier." And she said, "Bill, we brought him back home with us." I said, "What?" She said, "It's not just me now. There are a lot of people involved in this. And another couple had heard, and they gave him a room and their home. He didn't have drivers. He didn't have an automobile, so they were taking him places to various jobs. Someone picked him up in the morning, and someone brought him back home in the evening. They picked him up. He began to come to church. He eventually gave his life to Christ. He was baptized, joined the choir, got very involved in the church. Then he got a job that was permanent. Stayed in that job for 4 years. Lived those 4 years independently in his own apartment. He periodically had trouble with his alcohol addiction, but no one in the church family ever rejected him. They just kept their arms around him and loved him the whole way through. The company, after that 4th year, was bought out by another company, and the office here was shut down. He decided to go back home. I called Joe this week and said, "Tell me, As you heard from Chuck, he called last Thanksgiving and left a word on our answer machine, but just said hello. Have you heard anything from him? She said, it's kind of strange that you call. She said, I just asked somebody a couple of weeks ago about Chuck, and I said, how are you doing? She said, he's doing well. He's working regularly, and he's doing well. My brothers and sisters in this beautiful, marvelous church family, there are Chucks in our life, maybe whose stories are not nearly as dramatic, but just ordinary people in our families, in our church family, at school, in our neighborhoods, at work, people who need the transforming power of love to touch their life. Will that power flow through you?